Mars is a dry and frozen version of our home, covered in red dust and sand. At one time in the ancient past, Mars was very similar to the conditions of early Earth. You're listening to a Western World's special presentation. For another season and another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, sitting on top of the world's largest salt deposit in London, Ontario, Canada. Next Sunday evening, the capsule containing the Mars Science Laboratory rover, Curiosity, will hit the top of the Martian atmosphere at a speed of over 6 kilometers per second. It's the largest controlled spacecraft entry ever attempted at Mars, larger than even the Lunar Command Module capsule that carried the Apollo astronauts. If all goes well, 7 minutes of terror later, the Skycrane Precision Landing System will deliver Curiosity to the plains of Gale Crater on its wheels and ready to drive. Over the next Martian year, Curiosity, the most capable planetary rover ever built, will explore the history of Mars written in the rocks at Gale. Key to understanding that story is the central mound, a feature called Mount Sharp. This stack of layered rock rises more than 5 kilometers above the crater floor and may contain the longest accessible sedimentary record in the solar system. From orbit, this feature tantalizes with a clear transition from minerals thought to have been deposited in water during Mars's early history to the dry, wind-blown sediments of the Mars we know today. That duality between the Mars that is and the Mars that was is perhaps best expressed by tonight's mixed quotation from Brian Cox and Penelope Boston. Here at Western, we have a particularly close connection with the Mars Science Laboratory. That's because we have several scientists who will be part of Mission Control over the next few years, helping to decide each day what Curiosity will do next. Now that's important, because Curiosity's mission is a scientific one. We want to know how, when, and why the climate of Mars changed, and if Gale is the sort of place where clues to past habitability and life might be well preserved. I feel privileged to be one of those scientists, and this week on Western Worlds, we are featuring a discussion between myself and two of my collaborators on the MSL project, Raymond Francis and Emily McCullough. As for our music tonight, could there be any doubt? Only Gustav Holst's Mars can properly express the feeling of anticipation for next week's landing. So I'm here today with Raymond Francis and Emily McCullough, and together we sort of form a little research group here. We're all working together on the Mars Science Laboratory mission, along with one other collaborator, David Choi, from the Goddard Space Flight Lab. And I gotta say, we're getting pretty darn excited now. It's only, what, 17 days away from landing, I think? And by the time you hear this on the radio, it'll be less than a week. It's just 6 days.
It's coming up quick.
It is. Well, perhaps we should say a few words about how we got onto this mission in the first place and what it is that we're actually doing here. Because we didn't actually build this spacecraft, did we?
No. Sadly, no.
No, that's right. And in fact, we kind of joined the project just before it launched.
That's right. We got our letter telling us that our application to join was successful, I think, 2 days before the 23rd. This is an exciting day. Mm-hmm.
So by the time we came on the project, the spaceship was already designed, ready to go, and there was a call for proposals from scientists around the world. They didn't have to be NASA scientists, didn't have to be government scientists at all. So if you're a scientist and you have an idea of a new way that hadn't been thought of or proposed, in which the existing designed instrumentation that was already decided going to go to Mars, it's already built, nobody's changing that at this point. But if you have an idea for, how can I use these instruments in a different way than their original main purpose to get a different kind of measurement out of it, or a way in which you can use, say, two of these instruments from two different instrument teams synergistically together. If you can come up with an idea like that, there was a program called the Participating Scientist Program. You put in a proposal and you say, here's the plan. If we get some time, we'd like to use this instrument, that instrument, together in this way. We're hoping to get this kind of data out of it. And you plan the whole thing up. You send in your application and then you get to wait. And you wait and you wait and you wait. And eventually,
there you go. And here we are. And the great thing about this process is it brings in all sorts of people, and often younger folks who might have an interesting idea. And what we're talking about here is not completely different science. What we're talking about here are ways that enhance the science return from the already designed package.
Yeah, and of course, not to keep our listeners in suspense, but what we have actually proposed to do, of course, is atmospheric studies of Mars using instruments that were not always foreseen to look at the sky, but as much to look at the rocks and the solid surface. So we got a couple of components, right? We have, on the one hand, the atmospheric sounding with the laser that's part of the ChemCam instrument, and on the other, trying to understand the dynamics a little bit higher up in the atmosphere by visual tracking of clouds in photographs.
And of course, the reason that we get to do this is that the Canadian Space Agency actually contributed an instrument. We have a little thing on the robot arm called the APXS, the Alpha Particle X-ray Spectrometer, that will get us some elemental compositions of the rocks that we see on Mars. It's an instrument with a lot of heritage, and it's an important piece of the puzzle. And one of the great things about it is that because we are supplying some hardware, we also get to send some scientists.
Yeah, that's the price of participating in the mission, is contributing to it a little bit, right? And so here we're benefiting from this. And it sort of, you know, that kind of collaboration helps to expand both the sphere of cost and challenge of putting the mission together and the opportunities for participation. So we're benefiting from this already.
So this is your first mission, isn't it, Raymond and Emily?
It is indeed.
It's my first planetary mission. I've worked on some experiments for ISS, but this is the first time I'm in this position of contributing to the science team for a real planetary exploration mission.
Now, did you have the same sort of, was it the same sort of excitement heading up to launch for the ISS stuff?
It was pretty cool. I think when I was doing the ISS stuff, the experiment was launching with the lab it would run in. So we got it all at once. But I was on the engineering team. Once the thing launched, I wasn't going to contribute at all anymore. And now, of course, I get to have kind of a continuing role, hopefully.
So for you, this kind of starts when it gets to Mars.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting to be on the science side of it in that sense.
Well, you're someone who's no stranger to the science side of things, Emily, and this is your first time on any one of these planetary or space missions, is that right?
Yes. Of course, if you count Earth, I've worked on plenty of Earth missions, but first one off of our planet.
That's true. We always forget that that Earth is a planet too. Mm-hmm. Sort of that whole trick question about which planet is the best one.
But it's exciting to, you know, to have the robot this close to the atmosphere, and we're just waiting for a successful entry, descent, landing, and to see this landed package unfold itself and start working.
What do you think of that entry, descent, and landing phase? I know that's something. We might as well get it out of the way early because it's bound to come up. Lots of people ask me about it all the time. You're sort of cringing over there, Emily.
This is not cringing. This is excitement. I think this is fantastic. The whole space program, ever since its inception, has been really exciting and really trying to do things that haven't been done before, pushing boundaries, finding better and new ways to do things, to learn things. We're going to learn so much from this. Plus, it's just awesome.
There was a press release from NASA JPL a couple of months ago, just after one of the first trajectory correction maneuvers. It said, okay, the spacecraft is healthy, and by the way, the landing is coming up in a few months. And that landing, they said, and I quote, will employ bold techniques. And they're right. This is bold. But you know, this is the kind of thing you have to do to land big things. I don't know if people appreciate it. I mean, it looks charismatic, but the amount of novel techniques that go into making this work with the controlled lifting body stuff early on and the powered descent with imaging and autonomous navigation, these are really impressive things for a robot to do autonomously, even before it ever gets to the surface.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and because it's such a large rover, I mean, we're talking about something 900 kilos here. So. Mm-hmm. Six times the size of the Mars exploration rovers, mm-hmm. you run into all sorts of things just with that scale. I mean, things like the heat shield. You couldn't use the same ones before. You needed a tiled version. And you mentioned the lifting body. And mm-hmm. of course, everybody's favorite, the sky crane coming up right at the end.
Which, I mean, you know, I think about the dynamics of, I mean, you study pendulums in first year physics. Think about the dynamics of something like that coming down at a lot of speed and winching itself down towards the planet. It's amazing that this was the best answer.
It sometimes is surprising, but you think about it, you see that skeletal structure, mm-hmm. it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And when it works out, this will be a fantastic thing to say, look at what was achieved.
And a great thing, something you actually really need for larger bodies that will come. If you want to send astronauts, you're going to need to do it something like this. So that's sort of the getting there and that whole 7 minutes of terror that we're all going to enjoy coming up shortly. But then, of course, then we get down to the science side of things. That's really what it's about. I know each of you both have a role in the science here. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, most of the science team for the MSL mission is going to be looking at things like rocks and what's the water here on the surface and what is this aspect of the surface like? And we're going to be looking in the other direction. I'm really excited that we're going to get another chance to have a look at Mars's atmosphere. This is something for which we have a little bit of access due to satellites. We had some information come back from the Phoenix lander, which was really great. But now we've got a chance with a long surface mission where our rover is going to be driving around and we're going to be taking opportunistic measurements of the atmosphere.
Yeah, so it's a really neat thing. We don't just learn about water in the present day. We also get to look at what happened with water in the past and all of these stacked little sediments there. One of the things we want to figure out with Gale is that we want to know whether this is an area that might have been habitable in the past. And unfortunately, water in the current day is kind of a spoiler to that. We see a lot of stuff cycling around. It makes you wonder about the integrity of what's in those rocks.
But you know, while some of the science team will be making investigations and announcements about things that happened 2 billion years ago in the history of Mars, and we may be kind of in the position of saying, here's the things that happened 25 minutes ago. Here's the weather on Mars last night based on, you know, whether we can see moisture in the atmosphere and things like that, which is pretty cool.
That's true. And we haven't done that in a concerted way in the equator. We've gotten some lovely cloud images from Spirit and Opportunity, but this is a much more capable rover. And we'll be able to link up what it learns on the atmosphere with what Phoenix learned in a more polar setting. And as a result, get a better idea of how these things look on the surface across the whole face of Mars. Now, you've also done some work in the Arctic, which is another sort of cold and dry place. Can you tell us a little bit about that LIDAR type of stuff that you've done, Emily?
Sure. The work I've done previously has been, as John says, using a LIDAR, so using a laser beam. And in general, we shine it straight up in the atmosphere. It scatters off of all the little particles in the atmosphere. It can be oxygen, nitrogen, water vapor, dust, things like that in Earth's atmosphere. And the amount of light that scatters back towards our instrument, well, we put a telescope underneath, count it all up, and figure out how warm is the atmosphere? How is it moving? How dense is it? Are there clouds there? Is it snowing? We can learn all sorts of things just by shining a light. And so we're going to take some of those ideas and some of the same principles that make LIDAR in the Arctic work and apply that to Mars. Now, working up in the Arctic, it's a pretty extreme environment. You can't, if you've forgotten a part, you can't run to Canadian Tire and pick it up. You just can't. The nearest one is 4,000 kilometers away. Of course, on Mars, it's infinity away because you're not going back to get it. So in some respects, this is very similar in that you have to design your instrument, do your best at it, figure out what you'd like it to do, send it up there and hope for the best. And after the fact, you take what measurements you can and see if you can tease anything else out that you hadn't thought about engineering into it in the first place. And so how we're going to be using some of the data that comes back from the Curiosity rover is going to be similar in some respects to what we can do from the Arctic as well. Take an instrument that maybe somebody else has designed for, maybe they've optimized it for a certain purpose. Can we take that hardware and without hurting anything, without taking anything away from what others are going to be doing with it, can we learn something new that we hadn't considered asking before?
Yeah, that's one of the great things about some of this space hardware. It's characterized and engineered to such a high degree that you can do things with it that it wasn't initially designed to do. You can take a laser and a very sensitive imager, and you can make something that's a little bit like a LiDAR to give you some of that information. Both of these instruments working together, and neither one designed for that, but both very capable of doing it.
And of course, we're talking about the ChemCam instrument, right? This idea of taking that laser that was designed to vaporize rocks and sending it instead into the air to pretend it's a LiDAR and use it as one.
Yes, and in fact, this almost goes back to the very early days of LiDAR development, which were started with searchlights and cameras. I mean, now we have very collimated laser beams, they're very bright, they're specific wavelengths, and we have a telescope, and you get the biggest telescope you can find to get as many of those little photons of light back to count them all up. Of course, on the MSL mission, there wasn't a dedicated LiDAR put on there, but we do have a laser beam. Checkmark, great. Shine that in the sky. Can the little arm point it in the right direction? Sure can. Oh, how are we going to look at the light coming back from there? We don't have a telescope. Ah, but we've got several cameras we can use, and by using those together, we can tease out quite a bit of information.
And this is one of the things that people are always impressed when I tell them what we plan to do with MSL, where we're reallocating this rock analyzing laser to look at the sky. The idea that we can do something really different and that hopefully will work very well for a completely different purpose is really cool. And ChemCam is a cool instrument just to begin with.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's one of the real advantages of having a 900 kilogram rover is you can have incredible instruments. I mean, a full GCMS with a tunable laser spectrometer. I'm talking about SAM. And then, of course, you've got ChemN, which is a really, really sharp solution to combining XRF and XRD into a small package that you can rotate through. There's just no end. Mm-hmm. We've got DAN, which looks at the dynamic albedo of neutrons. It's basically like the GRS instrument that's on Mars Odyssey, but it's 1 meter above the surface. And of course, we've got the nuclear power to operate all the time and several other instruments. We can't get into them all. We have limited time here.
Yeah. But they include, of course, an array of cameras, not just one sitting there pointing wherever we ask it to, but a whole different set of cameras. One to look up very close, things in high resolution like MOLLE, we have the ones on the mast, we're all over the place. And this is very useful for our other project of looking at the motions of clouds in the atmosphere. So it'll be nice to have that diversity of tools because we'll be tripping over photographs almost. It's nice to have a richness of data.
It's true. We've got sort of both spheres of influence here. We look at the atmosphere, but we also very much look at the ground. And beyond the atmospheric side, which of course interests us, we're also going to be participating in the operations, and we're helping to figure out what this rover does every day and where it's going and why it's going to go there as it tries to tease out this mystery of Gale Crater and what's been going on here in the past. I mean, that's just exciting to plan for this kind of distance and this kind of climate.
Yeah, and this is an exciting place to be in, is to contribute to the planning of a mission. It's one thing to do analysis of science data or to design an instrument, but to help operate a spacecraft, in this case on the surface of a planet. You know, after having spent a lot of time working here at Western in space analog operations, to actually exercise those muscles on a real mission will be a lot of fun, I think.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very exciting for people at Western to sort of scale up what we've got a bit of experience doing on the ground, analog missions, and for me in particular, and Raymond as well, on the science team side of an analog mission. How does that scale to real life? How does that scale instead of having a room of 20 scientists arguing over what should take priority, what order should you have the rover do tasks in, all of these things? How do you scale that to 1,000 people in teams, international teams, not everybody co-located at Mission Control? How do you do that? How does this work? This is a real great opportunity for Raymond and myself to be able to see how this works in real life.
And this is what it's all about. I mean, when it comes to space missions, there are very few real missions where you have tiny groups of people who all agree on a small set of goals, right? With MSL, you have a large number of instruments, you have huge teams of people, and you have to get operations to work with scientific goals but engineering constraints. And you need to match both of those things up. And it's complex and it's difficult, and you have to make diverse teams of people work together. And space exploration needs that skill and that ability at a personal and an organizational level. So getting that early in your career is great.
Yeah, and of course, leading into all this, how did we get excited is that John came in and said, "Hey, I've got all this experience on previous missions. It was awesome. It was really, really interesting. I learned a whole lot. So John was a very big inspiration in thinking that, you know, this is a chance we really shouldn't pass up.
Yeah, we talked about this being the first planetary mission for Emily and I, but of course John has done a couple before.
That is true, and I'm going to be curious to see what your reaction is to it now that you've got a little bit of skin in the game for this spacecraft coming down. It's, like you say, it's not the first time for me. I've been on a couple of others of these particular kinds of missions, and I don't know, that first image, that's why I'm in this business, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the science team here, and we should point out this is a science-driven mission. We're going there to actually do the science. It's the purpose for it. And something I really love about planetary exploration is that we may start out as separate teams, and many of us actually are, you know, on paper anyway, divided into teams associated with one instrument or another instrument. But when we go down to JPL and when we meet on the telephone, all of those divisions disappear, and we become one big science team trying to figure out the best thing to do with this piece of hardware. And so I think both of you guys will really enjoy this.
I'll be looking forward to that. And in particular, you know, my work that I'm doing now is very much about the intersection between science and engineering, and getting engineering to support science. I've had a lot of background in the sort of mission design and hardware design world, but now I'm doing stuff that is all about being at the service of scientific investigation. So I need to understand that science and how the scientists work and how science missions operate. So this is a fantastic place to see it actually working and alive and doing what it's supposed to do. So this would be very useful for me to understand that world.
And those constraints, I mean, it really is on the edge. We only have so far that we can go, so many measurements that we can take in a day. We're scientists. We would love to do full panoramas of everything and every filter and exercise every instrument every day. But there's a limit to what you can do, and there's a prioritization. And it forces you to come together and make those trades and figure out what's the best pathway through. And with a rover like this, which has a destination to it, you know, it's almost scary, you know, the pressure to actually make sure you get done the things that need to get done at each spot before you move on.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's tremendously complex. Power budgets, data budgets, flight rules that limit what instrument can work at the same time or before and after another one, the best time of day to take a particular picture, all the different constraints about how to get the most information out of this, which observations are the most valuable? Is it this rock over here, or is it this patch of sky?
Right, and it's not always easy, is it, to prioritize one particular scientific measurement over another? We can't distill out science value from these things.
Certainly not a priori.
Yeah, it's quite difficult. I mean, that was something I know that you did a lot of work with when we were doing our analog tests.
Yes, well, and it's difficult when every science goal is valid and worthy and will tell you something new about what you're trying to look at. It's Mars. There's a ton of stuff we don't know. A ton! So much stuff we don't know. And so any direction you'd like to take it, there will be value there. And the question is balancing to maximize your returns. And you can do that in one area, delving very deeply and focusing on one particular goal. Or you can do a very broad scale and get a kind of overview of 100 different things if you like. But at some point, you're going to maximize balancing enough concentration in one area that you get real scientific value there. You can actually start answering some questions, start narrowing down, start shrinking some uncertainty bars. Balancing that with getting information in a few different areas. I mean, there's geology, there's potential biology, there's atmospheric measurements, there's just general physics of being somewhere else in completely different conditions, there's the engineering things you're going to learn. Even if everything breaks, you're going to learn something.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, of course, you will see decisions about, in the data budget, how much do we assign to engineering data so we know how the health of the rover is and what's going on. Because there's a lot to be learned from operating machinery on the surface of a planet, particularly if it's a planet we hope to put more machines on later.
Well, that's a good point there, is that Mars, more than many other solar system bodies, we've really had the benefit since the late 90s of having a concerted program, a concerted effort. It may seem in the public sphere that we have these random missions that go for specific reasons, specific times, but each one leads into the next one. For instance, we have the Mars Exploration Rovers following up on what the Mars Global Surveyor spacecraft saw with its orbital cameras. We have the Phoenix lander following up on the observation of water ice from Odyssey. And now we have MSL, which is sort of where we've been leading, following up on some of the things that have been seen by the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. I mean, Gale is an interesting, tantalizing place from orbit. If you know anything about the geography of Mars, and I encourage you to go and take a look at a map, Mars is a strange place. It's got two main different kinds of terrain. It's a dichotomy. And we have lowlands in the north. They're young, not terribly cratered. Some think that perhaps there was a sea there at some point. In the south, we've got highlands, heavily cratered, very old, and just absolutely dissected with things that look like old river valleys and channels from Mars's early history. And Gale sits here right on the border between the two of them, in a region where it looks like it built up sediment and it's been cut back down again.
Yeah, this is a fantastic landscape to imagine operating in, and we'll see it from the cameras. But first of all, we have this crater, which is not a small one. It's something like 100 kilometers across.
I think 155.
Yeah, this is a significant size, with the mountain in it on the order of 5 kilometers high. And at the same time as having this huge crater that you're in, so large that it almost probably will look like just a large valley from the inside rather than a feature of distinct crater shape. It's going to have dunes inside. It's going to have this mountain next to it. The vistas that you're going to have and the geological implications of an impact crater with sedimentary layers and then overprinted with sand and dunes and winds blowing through and who knows what kind of cloud formations. We're going to have a fantastic place to play around with this rover.
Indeed, and you mentioned that mound. We're going to climb this thing.
This is it, yeah. You know, the idea of not only are we going to kind of amble around on the planet, we're going to go mountain climbing with this thing.
And for atmospheric measurements, this is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing atmospheric measurements where maybe you can't see very far with your instrument, okay, we're not going to be looking 100 kilometers in altitude with this thing. Nowhere near that. And so if you can start at the bottom of a crater and only look a couple hundred meters up, oh, but then your rover drives a little ways and it goes up 100 meters. Well, now you're at where the end of your old measurements were. Oh, do some new ones. Point it up. Now you can get another 100 meters in altitude. Or point it sideways and look through what it was you were looking up through before.
And considering the properties of the Martian atmosphere, 5 kilometers is a significant thickness if we can climb a big part of that height.
Absolutely. The Mars atmosphere is not particularly thick, nor near as thick as Earth's atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So this is a really big advantage, just in the way the whole mission was planned from the start, turns out to be very convenient for the measurements we're hoping to do.
Yeah, it's a very unique case for atmospheric sounding.
Yeah, what we're really talking about here is a transect of the sky.
Yeah, which is a fun way to think about climbing up there. We don't need to have a stratospheric balloon mission. We can just drive up the hill with the robot.
Oh, you didn't pack any of those?
Balloons?
On the rover?
No.
Oh, you're supposed to sneak some in.
Well, maybe something on the descent.
Well, I know we'll definitely have a celebration when it touches down.
There'll be balloons, yeah.
There will be balloons here.
And Joan, where will you be for the celebration?
Well, I'm still hopeful I'll be down at the Jet Propulsion Lab on site, just there with many of the other scientists, you know, with bated breath, waiting for that image or that tone or that command from the folks in the control room, say, it's there, it's landed, and then that wait for the first image.
Yeah, and for my part, of course, I'll be with our partners at the Canadian Space Agency, who are, you know, helping us take part in this mission.
And for my part, instead of being with scientists and mm-hmm. government, I'm going to be with the people. We are excited about a spaceship going to Mars. The public is excited about an instrument going to Mars, a rover going to Mars. So I'm going to be celebrating here at Western at the Cronin Observatory. We're having an overnight event. It's going to be great. And I plan to be there. Same deal, though. Watching, waiting, fingers crossed that everything touches down gently.
Well, luckily here in Ontario, at least, we have a holiday the next day, so there's no problem with staying up till 1:30 in the morning to watch this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think I could make some time, perhaps.
Yeah. And this is cool. I'm really glad that Western and CPSX are putting that event on, because, you know, this is way too cool an event to not be sharing with the public.
Absolutely. It's very important.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured a discussion between Raymond Francis, Emily McCullough, and John Moores. Our editors were John Moores and Michael Forster. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.